Great. Well, thank you very much. My name is Sarah Diesberg, and I'm from Florida State University. And today I'll be talking to you about our research, Full Data Path Secure Deletion. So most people know what secure deletion is. It's erasing all traces of a file after the user deletes the file, and doing so irrevocably. But the problem is that a lot of the fine-grained solutions that only concentrate on maybe one file or one directory only operate on one segment or level of the data storage path. So for example, there might be a secure deletion application and there might be a secure deletion file system. But unfortunately, when these separate components interact with other components of the data path, things may happen in which data may be left over. And so our solution is to develop a holistic, full data path-wide approach to securely erase files. So when is fine-grained secure deletion important? When do we care about just deleting one file? Well, when we personally want to get rid of one file without toasting our drives. When we switch away from any large organization to another large organization that holds our sensitive data. When we're decommissioning hard drives and we just want to erase these sensitive things and we want to do it quickly, or also military purposes along the same vein. So are the current methods good enough? And we argue not really. Like I said before, they tend to be isolated on one part of the data path, and there to the left is a general operating system data path. And applications, for example, secure deletion applications, cannot delete information about files such as file metadata because it just doesn't have access to the file system to do such things. So you might delete a file data or file data, but the name might be left behind. File systems, when they're secure deleting, they actually may hold hidden copies of information, like in a journal, consolidate writes, like in a page cache, or not honor in-place overwrites, like if they do some sort of compression. And even the storage media itself may not honor in-place overwrites, such as overwriting directly pieces of sensitive data, such as flash, which actually keeps dead data and overwrites in another area due to wear leveling. So, our solution is composed of two parts. One part is a centralized module that passes secure deletion information from the file system, which knows a whole lot about the files, such as if they're sensitive or not, and it knows whether it's performing a truncate or an unlink, down to the lower layer, such as the block layer, which really doesn't know anything except for read and write commands. And then we extend the block layer to take advantage of the extra secure deletion information that's passed to it. And then that block layer can issue secure delete overwrite commands, for example, or call storage-specific secure deletion commands, depending on the different type of media we have underneath. So this is a Linux data storage path. And off to the right there is my secure deletion module. Very generally, we export a function. So right after, say, well, right during an unlink, after the page cache flush, we go ahead and we add information about the block write that's happening. So when you delete from a file system, there's usually some sort of metadata update that takes place, whether it be the file inode update or free bitmap update. When that happens, we can ask the file system, are there associated blocks which you just deallocated? And if so, we can add this to our secure deletion module, which will act as a database in memory. Later on, when that write finally propagates to the block layer can ask our secure deletion module if there's anything they need to do with that specific block number, like delete. And our module can say yes or no, and yes, please delete these blocks before you update the metadata on disk, for example. And then the block layer can issue the correct secure delete command depending on the underlying media. So we've got a lot of approach advantages to this. The biggest ones are that it can work with any file system. We're just exporting module functions. It can work with any type of block layer, so any type of storage underneath. And it doesn't mess with the behavior of the data storage path. So current development, we've implemented both secure write and secure delete block layer commands. Now we know what secure delete is, but secure write is useful for devices like flash that don't honor in-place overwrites. We can tell the flash to erase dead data as we're writing from a sensitive file. And I'm using Linux 2.6 with ext3 and NAND flash right now for our prototype. Any very, well, no questions. Please take it offline. Thank you.
Other one, isn't it?
No, mirroring.
There you go. Well, you're applauding, but it's actually wrong. Because I made this. There, turn on mirroring. This will make it all perfect. There we go. Famous last words. Okay, and it's moved stuff around so you can see things where I don't want you to see them. Yeah, these are slides that are terminal windows. Okay, though I am fighting the use of strong high entropy passwords because people have trouble entering them, and we've known this for a long time, nevertheless, you still need to do this every once in a while. For example, you ought to lock the key ring in your iPhone in such a way that if someone else gets it, a dictionary attack is not going to succeed for a very long time. This is a hard game to play, and we often end up with passwords such as something like the top one. Imagine 53HGR trying to enter that in the iPhone. You're switching all sorts of keyboards. It is tedious, and you're likely to get it wrong. A better one would be a bunch of words, especially if the spelling checker is helping you. Now, we're not cutting down on the entropy. We still pick the words from a pool and get that part right. But the problem is that these particular words are really bad ones to choose. And the reason is because if you mistap them, you're likely to pick another word, run into another word that is in the dictionary, and the iPhone won't help you. So my goal for this was to find a list of words that when you make tapping mistakes, I call them tapos, that the spelling checker will say, oh, you meant this, and will fall back to your original input. So I want you to be able to tap as quickly as possible and have it correct on the way and get your entropy in and get you on with life. So that's slide one. Boom, go. Yeah. Oh, do I want to close this one? Okay, so here's a list of bad choices. Goes has, by a very simple tapo paradigm I have, all of these other 19 other words that it could be. That would be a bad word to pick. Okay, so obviously what we want to do is go down to the bottom of this, where based on my tapo model, things aren't so bad. And we have them right here. Here are words that are okay, and I'll make this bigger for you. And we can go through here. Now, I got this word list from the Mac, so you may not like them, you may not say their words. But for example, all of these are fairly tapo resistant. And if you go down here, we're up to 5 letters. And if you limit the input words to just 6 letters, I've got about 1024 of them, which means 5 of these easy to tap words would give you a 50-bit input. Not bad. Now, of course, I've used a very crude model of how you might mistap, and people have already shown it. Those of you who have iPhones, I recommend you pull out the iPhone now and go to your memo input, and you could try, I'll zoom back. This is loser's game here. Zoom back here, and I actually had the computer choose a few words. You might imagine certainly the first 5 words, ring cycle crime under bonus, that's a 50-bit password. How fast can you type that if you just type clearly, hitting spacebar, and forget the correction stuff, just let it clean up after you? At least for the model of my extensive user testing on the train, it worked really well. So this was actually picked with fairly strong, these are actually random words. So you could try tapping space sorts faint sport clerk. And of course you could pick any 5 that got generated for you and it would still be in a big key space. So anyway, that's the basic idea. Obviously it needs a lot more work. This might be a Chi paper. I was going to stand up here and say that I was looking for a couple of students to take this and run with it, but Steve Bellavin is helpfully supplied to. Well, there are usability studies involved in this and background work and probably a better model of how TAPOs go. It would be nice to get information out of Apple about how they do some of this stuff. And of course, the paper had better reference what Steve had mentioned about code groups that are resistant to errors, because this is not a new idea. So has anyone tried and succeeded to enter that password? Show of hands, a few of you. And does it seem like a crap to some of you because you tried it and it just didn't work? No? Okay. And that's it.
Great. I'm Will Eng from Penn State, and this is work along with Intel Research in Seattle, where I'm doing an internship this summer. So, mobile phone security. I don't think I really need to motivate this to anybody in here. But the things that I think are interested with mobile phone security is downloaded third-party applications. How do they affect the phone? How do they affect each other? How do they affect user privacy? So I've been looking at mobile phone security from the perspective of Android, and if you were at the keynote, you learned a lot about Android. But I'm interested in Android from a research perspective, not only because it's this nice open source system we can make changes to, but because it has some interesting interactions between applications. They're not isolated at the application level, and there's this policy mechanism here, and there's different ways of controlling how they can interact. And so I've been looking at that, and we have a nice CCS paper on that, which you can go check out in a few months. But I'm going to talk about some of the stuff that I'm doing this summer. And so let's take a location-aware application that seems to be all the rage right now, Twitter client. And so the Twitter client can detect when you go to a new location and tweet that location up. And so in order for this application to function, the functional requirements say, I need a location privilege and I need an internet privilege. Now, when that application is going to run, you can uncheck a checkbox that says, don't show my location. But you still need that permission on that application because in Android, permissions are static. So wouldn't it be nice to be able to go and say, well, how is this application actually using the information? And so we can look system-wide how information sort of flows around. And we started looking at how can we apply taint tracking to mobile phones. So we started looking at this and said, hey, this might actually work out pretty well. Mobile phones seem to be pretty amenable to taint tracking concepts because on a mobile phone, from a privacy perspective, sensitive information has a lot of these single-purpose interfaces. You get microphone information from the microphone API, location information, address book information, and these interfaces can be auto-tagged. And so we can just let things propagate through the system and then check it at the network buffer when it's going to go out and say whether or not this is going to be tainted. Now, anyone who's familiar with taint tracking and doing this on desktop PCs says, hey, wait a second, this is really heavyweight operations. How are we going to do this on a mobile phone? This is going to be a problem. But we'd like to have this. So flip things around, maybe go the other direction, and we'll do it application level. Look at the processes, and we'll look how the information comes into them. But we lose some accuracy there of actually how these applications are using things. So we dug a bit deeper. And so we had this goal of trying to incorporate taint tracking into the Android phone. And so we started looking at the applications. Well, one thing we know is the applications are written in Java. And so if we start making some assumptions, untrusted codes inside of the virtual machine running, well, now we can instrument the virtual machine interpreter to track information. And so we've done this, and we're tracking variables, primitives and arrays as they go through. And so as you can see here, sort of our changes, blue spots are where we've made changes, gray spots are where we've let things go. And we have it working pretty well. Now, it's not perfect. We use explicit information flow analysis, so we're missing the implicit stuff. And there's some native stuff we need to patch, but overall, it seems to operate pretty well. So I got this, actually, just this past weekend, I got this running on one of these phones. I haven't really done any formal benchmarking on it yet. But as it turns out, using the techniques that we applied in here, it runs without any really noticeable lag, at least that I could see. So I think we've learned some things initially. It's still some preliminary work, but it seems like that taint tracking is a nice approach to get some additional security information on these mobile phones. We have these nice places to auto tag, and we can do it practically, making some trade-offs and pushing it into the virtual machine. So I think we have some time. If anyone has any quick questions, or you can drop by afterwards and I can answer them then.
My name is Randy Martin. I'm from George Mason University. My advisor is Dr. Angelo Stavro. My partner, Fox Chambers, and I have been working on a project we call Cacophony, which you will see shortly. Synced. Cacophony. Cacophony is near and dear to our hearts. Why? Because we all like to use BitTorrent. And educational institutions and other ISPs and some other organizations throttle your BitTorrent connection, deny it. And so we are coming up with alternate means to be able to use the BitTorrent network or a similar network in conjunction with BitTorrent while completely bypassing the network policy. Here are some of the current techniques. You have HTTP proxy, VPN. Some use alternate networks like Tor. Our approach is to use VoIP. Why VoIP? Because it's increasingly prevalent. This is something you'll be seeing more, and this is not something that's usually denied. And so we use the VoIP-related protocols, SIP, RTCP, RTP, and we emulate precisely, or as closely as we can, a VoIP phone call. So we negotiate a connection using SIP, then we encapsulate the torrents into RTP, and then tear down the call just like a VoIP phone call. So here's your usual BitTorrent layout. You have the web server with the torrent, you have the tracker, you have your seeds and pairs. Here's it on the cacophony. Well, we maintain certain things. It's going to be HTTP to the web server. The tracker runs on various ports, as you know. Some can be 80, can be 6969, what have you. But for the pairs and the seeds, we actually negotiate a phone call. And if you actually, and the thing is, to a listening network node, Snort, whatever running on it, it actually looks like a SIP phone call. If we've analyzed the data in our trial runs and it actually appears and does appear to the system to be a legitimate phone call. So let me just break it down for you a little bit. You initiate the session using SIP. The set of information makes the systems recognize it as an RTP data connection about to start. We encapsulate the packets, send it out from the BitTorrent application and send it out. The monitoring node on the other end receives VoIP phone call, it sets up the communication, it de-encapsulates the packet, and then passes it to the BitTorrent application. Now let me just make some acknowledgements here. Yes, I know the overhead of encapsulating data is somewhat significant, and we've done some primary tests on that. We've done a single-threaded system where it's just two users, one pair, one seeds, what have you. And we did this in Python, and we know that there is an overhead involved, but that was just the preliminary testing. Now we're moving into the second phase where we're writing an application. It's going to be multi-threaded. It's going to have to conform to either of the three the architectures of VoIP phone calls, whether it's a pair-to-pair call, whether it's through a server, whether it's hybrid. And so we have to emulate that as well, because it can be suspicious if there are 15,000 phone calls going on at the same time. But so we actually have considered that and calculated that into our application. So this is where we are right now. We're in phases of testing. And if there are any questions about what we've done or what we're planning to do.
Can you make it so that if someone is eavesdropping and listening to the SIP call, it sounds like a 1990s era modem transmission?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I'm going to Yeah,
you got it. Oh, great. I'm glad Linux works automagically. I'm presenting on Oscar. My name's Pat Wilbur. I'm from Clarkson University. And Todd Ashane's sitting over there, brown hat. The goals of our work with Oscar are to mitigate malware problems and to try to, importantly, to try to eliminate the majority of their payload, because we see that people keeping malware even as they install antivirus and anti-spyware, and some of that actually is malware. So we want to try to create a system that can mitigate the payload of malware and significantly decrease the recovery time, recovery cost. We're also trying to use virtual machines to enforce the principle of least privilege, and actually to also enforce the principle of least privilege on virtual machines, or what we like to call virtual appliances. And we also are looking to improve the security and distributability of these virtual appliances. So they're very portable. People can download these. A virtual appliance might be a web server, or it could even be a web browser if this was moved to the desktop. So what is Oscar? Oscar is a virtualization security policy enforcement framework. Basically, it consists of a policy manager, and virtual machines are bundled with contracts, and you also have global security policy, and it just tries to weigh what the virtual machine needs with the environment that you're working with. It manages the entire life cycle of a virtual machine and all the interactions with that virtual machine, and we place all the security policy enforcement agents actually outside of the OSs and the applications you're going to be securing. And there are some obvious benefits to that. One is that you don't have to modify the OSs or the applications, and also if the OSs or applications are compromised, the policies might be intact. Oscar ensures that there's a sane environment actually capable of running the virtual machine or the virtual appliance that you want to run on your system. So if a virtual machine or an appliance requests that it be protected in a certain way, it makes sure that it can be protected in that certain way. It also ensures the sane operation of that virtual machine to try to protect your system and any systems on your network or in the immediate vicinity of that virtual machine. It does this by not only controlling the resources that a virtual machine may use, but it also monitors the resources that the VM has access to and tries to watch out for abuse of those resources. We use intrusion detection systems and the like for that. The contracts that we're working with are highly abstract and extensible contracts. We believe that the virtual machine or appliance creator knows best how to protect the virtual machine, so we really want to give them all the freedom that they need to be able to do that. And we definitely feel that they know how to protect their own virtual machine or application better than the end user would who's installing it. Contracts depict the unique security environment in which a VM should run. They also depict how to detect problems and how to detect resource abuse and how we're going to respond to these problems. Are we going to roll back? Are we going to snapshot, pause the VM, alert the authorities, whatever we need to do. An example is a toaster. So you can think of a virtual appliance kind of like a kitchen appliance, right? You go to the store, you buy it, you unbox it, you plug it in, it should just run, and it should have some safety precautions in it where it doesn't, it doesn't gain access to a resource that it shouldn't have access to. For instance, it shouldn't pick up a gun and start shooting your family. That would be pretty bad, right? And another thing is like with resource abuse. Maybe you've given it access to a lot of power and it has access to a heating coil, so you intend to use that to toast some bread or something, right? But it shouldn't toast your hand or toast your family or burn your house down. So we really, we think that it's important to watch out for resource abuse, not only limit what resources something can access. And then, how to respond to problems. How are we going to extinguish a problem when it occurs? There are a few different faces to our Oscar project. Just by developing some interfaces and some tricky contract rules, we've been able to use Oscar to help consolidated servers play nicely. We made a public access terminal with like kiosked OSs that automatically roll back and give people all the features and access they want as root or whatever, but make sure that they aren't abusing that, taking down systems on your network, hacking the FBI, whatever you don't want them to do. We're working on a rapid recovery desktop and application segregation, and that's all the time I've got. Check out our website. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Brent Hoon Kang. I'm an assistant professor at UNC Charlotte. Oh, that's weird. Where is it? This is the work with my student Greg Sinclair, and he's currently a full-time employee at iDefense as well. And today I'm going to share some of the, it's not like about the technology, it's more about our observation and what are our thoughts and what we should do next kind of thing. So some of you may know what is the WallyDAG. WallyDAG is a P2P botnet. And in researching this P2P botnet, we made a lot of friends and collaborators. We indebted to these folks, to the knowledge that we have right now, and Georgia Tech and Canada, Ecole Polytech University, and a friend from German. And of course, many malware research community to contribute here and there. All right, let's get to the bottom line. So this is the WallyDAG hierarchical structure that, to the best of knowledge, it's there. And we have a little more detailed information, but I couldn't share the higher layer a little bit just for now. And as you can see, the bottom layer here is the spammer node. Basically the bandmaster use these nodes to do a lot of dirty works, sending out spam or doing some DDoS. We haven't seen much DDoS from this particular botnet, but they mostly do the spamming. And this repeater is more like one higher up, and they chose the botnet to act as a repeater if the botnet is capable of getting accessible from outside, which means if they're not behind the net or firewall, then they choose them to act as a repeater layer. What this repeater layer does is it simply forwards whatever message coming from spammer node to the higher up node so that the upper layer can be protected. Their IP locations and their can be protected by the repeater layer. So because of having this architecture, and also each node has their neighbor table. Because each node has their neighbor table, one might think that maybe it's easy for us to black hole or sinkhole this entire spammer and repeater layer. I mean, that's one thing that people thought of before. And another possibility is, well, we know that these three are TSL layer. TSL layer is basically one layer above the repeater layer. And basically their main job is protecting the hierarchical real bondmaster node. And if we know all the location of this TSL layer, yes, we can go after them and take it down. What I'm going to share from now on is, I'm going to share every scenario that what would happen if you do this. If you take down this TSL layer, you think that the bot would not be able to survive again. But based on our reverse engineered code analysis, we found that they had a very nice failover mechanism. What it would do is that they would be able to make a number of repeaters that bondmaster has a direct control of, and they can make them as a TSL layer. And the access to the TSL layer and then the message from TSL layer is signed by TSL private key. So they use PKI, which is unlike the previous Storm binary. And because of that, it would be very difficult for the researchers or defenders to play any type of man in the middle either. And TSL layer, even if you shut it down, they can easily reconstruct the TSL layer. Then what would be the next step then? Well, if you cannot take down the TSL, if that's not going to work, then how about we sinkhole or black hole the entire the repeater layer, because we all know that any P2P network in general, if you can supply your IP long enough and a large number of your IPs that you have in control of, then they'll be able to talk to you instead of talking to the bandmaster or their repeater node. And that's the another possibility. But if you do that, and they have a nice failable mechanism that they are looking for the FastFlux DNS domain name, and unless we have access to a capability of shutting down FastFlux DNS controller, you wouldn't be able to do it. Okay. All right. The just last slide. All right. Okay, this is a change that we said. I'd love to share more about this later. Thank you.
So I'm Steve McLaughlin from Penn State University, and today I'm going to tell you about hacking electric meters. So usually whenever we make technology choices as to what kind of computer-related stuff we're going to use in our lives, we use our security expertise to make decisions like, well, perhaps I don't consider OSA secure, so I'll choose to use OSB on my laptop. In about the next 5 years, electric utilities are going to make a security-related decision for you and go ahead and stick a solid-state or smart meter on the side of your house, and it's going to watch every watt you consume and report it to the internet. So let me tell you a bit about how smart meters work and what the smart grid is, as well as why we're studying their security and how we're going about it. So the basic idea behind the smart grid is you take a bunch of smart meters, which are just a regular electric meter with the electromechanical guts replaced with some circuitry, and then you connect these to several different communication networks for the purpose of reporting information to customers, the utilities, and the grid. So customers, the idea is, are going to use this information to work with time-based pricing schemes in order to reduce costs and perhaps even reduce the peak demand on the grid itself. The grid will use it for power quality management, and the utilities will use it for things like dynamic demand response and load shedding. The idea behind those is that you could actually prevent rolling blackouts. So how does this work? Well, typically you'll have an installation of meters in a neighborhood or perhaps an apartment building, and you'll have a local meter LAN, and most of the meters in that LAN are going to act repeater nodes. They're going to forward usage information, which is actually called demand, to a single gateway node or a collector, perhaps one or two of them, and then they'll be connected to some backhaul link that will then send that information to the electric utility. So examples of the typical backhaul links are the public switch telephone network and the internet. So obviously you're probably suspecting that in a system this complex, not to mention the fact that there's servers running on the utility, there's also even further back-end servers that distribute programs to the utilities to then reprogram the meters with. So it's a fairly non-trivial SCADA system, and it would be good to have some kind of methodology in order to study it. So what we're doing is actually taking sort of a structured top-down approach to penetration testing. So normally one might just take one of these meters and look at every interface and begin fuzz testing it, and of course you would find bugs, you would find vulnerabilities. But what you might not find is a workable exploit to do something like commit energy fraud or inject false data into the grid. So what we're doing is using an attack tree methodology, where basically, some of you may be familiar with this, at the root of the attack tree, you would just have a goal, in this case, The goal is to forge demand in order to commit energy theft. And then you just define sub-goals as the child nodes until eventually you reach the leaves of the trees, and those would be the types of attacks you would have to mount or the types of exploits or vulnerabilities you would have to find. So just to give you one example as to how we're using these attack trees, here is a pretty basic attack tree for committing energy fraud. So if you look at the leftmost branch, you'll notice that these are all things involving kind of electromechanical attacks. And then as you move to the other branches in the tree, you see sort of more sophisticated types of attacks that are based on the technologies and smart meters. One thing to bear in mind as you're looking at a lot of these attacks is that they require physical access, which is a fairly reasonable threat model, we think, for penetration testing these meters, because they are fairly prolific. There's one on every house or apartment building. And actually, precedent shows that there's about $6 billion in energy theft per year with current electromechanical meters, which can only be hacked through physical means. So using the top-down approach, we've already looked at the energy theft from the previous tree, and we're going to publish these results at the 4th International Workshop on Critical Infrastructure and Communication Security. I think that's going to be in Germany this year. And we got some pretty interesting results. So the first thing you notice is that if you were to physically, at the right time of day, unplug a meter from its phone connection, which might not be particularly hard to do as it seems like some utilities are looking at just sharing the home phone line with the meter, you would be able to impersonate the meter using just a regular computer and forge demand values or forge the ID and make it look like you're your neighbor's meter or whatever. And then a lot of the other vulnerabilities we found, things like clear text passwords being used over a near field security type interface called an optical port, which is just a little infrared LED port, or things like this so-called intrusion detection feature, which is easily defeatable just by putting a small computer running some PBX software in between the meter and the utility. We think that these things are just, more theatrical than useful security features. So basically, we're going to be using the same style of methodology as you saw here, and we're just going to replace the root of the tree with things like false data injection to try and cause rolling blackouts. And we'll proceed from there, and hopefully we'll submit something to Oakland. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sergey from Concord University here from Montreal. So I'll talk briefly about my current work and research for my PhD studies, which is in this long title. Essentially, what I'm working on is to refine a formal cyber forensic approach that was done by Gladyshev to model a cyber crime case and to do event reconstruction. In this case, Gladyshev used a finite state automata approach, which during my work I refined using a language called Forensic Lucid, so it's more usable. And then furthermore, what Gladyshev did not do, and I still didn't do, but in progress of doing, is that there's something missing to describe credibility of witnesses or evidence in the case. Another work that has been going on in the same field was intentional logic approach, which is multidimensional view of any other type of logic. Essentially, you have a context, which is a dimensions. You have multiple dimensions, which is infinite stream of values, and they represent the context of evaluation. So it was emphasized by a language Lucid. All the way back to 76 and until now, this active research. So essentially, I combine all the three. So I also didn't mention the Dempster-Shaffer theory, which gives you a mathematical theory of evidence and trustworthiness and credibility. So I combine all the three together, Gladyshev's work, new approach of adding credibility factors to it, and using the intentional logic approach. So I'll just give some examples. Now, what Gladyshev did, he said, okay, I have all these models, essentially how do I compose my evidence? It's a, on the top level, I have an evidential statement, which is a collection of stories told by witnesses and pieces of evidence, somehow encoded, which in turn is a collection of observations. And somehow you compute the meaning of those. One of the examples to give was a case, a sample case involving Alice and Bob, and they share a printer, and then he says, okay, Bob saw Alice printed, but she says she didn't, so an investigator came in and started to do a crime scene analysis in case of the printer, so he mapped the printer states into this state machine that you see. And basically, investigator has to put this state machine together involving manufacturer Alice and Bob and see, let's say, from the final state investigator found the printer and is there a path all the way back to, let's say, when the printer was bought that does not involve Alice printing a job. There's a lot more work behind that. So, but it's not super usable to for investigators to do that all the time, and that's one of the purpose of forensic lucid language I'm developing. And it represents the evidential statement, observation, and observation sequences, the stories, as a context of evaluation, which is a core concept of any lucid dialect. So we have a hierarchical notion of context. So context, some people may be familiar with as ontologies or other things, depending what they work with, for location-aware applications and so on. So we encode this as an evidential statement, and we have a syntax, semantics, and all that described in the language, how it's encoded. And in the case of the printer case, like, the goal is to prove that still there is no possibility that Alice did not print that print job that Bob says he saw her picking up. So we do event reconstruction from the final state of the printer that was found and back to the possible traces. So we want to build a collection of traces like this, like Ladishov did, and say, yes, it's possible or not. And then this is an example of a programming lucid. And what we extend his approach was to add the weight and the time step to the observation sequence. So this gives us ability to compute credibility. So one naive approach to compute credibility is just an averaging. Another one is similar to a neural network and weight. That's what we developing and trying to see which works best. So some references and some previous work, and thank you.
I'm Sun Xin, and I'd like to introduce our project called the LLAK project. And then first I introduce the LLAK protocol shortly, and then show some demonstrations of our project. As you know, the authenticated key exchange is a very core cryptography primitive, and you know, to realize the authentication and secure channels, and these AK protocols can be found in many the SSA, TLS, SSA, and IPsec, and these protocols are designed to be secure against active attacks. And then also these the previous AK protocols are based on the assumption that the stored secrets, including the authentication information, are secure. However, what happens if the stored secrets are leaked? Unfortunately, most of the AK protocols become insecure. In fact, the leakage of stored secrets and data is very common, and it's really the practical threat in the real world, and due to lost or stolen devices such as PCs and the mobile phones and so on. Our motivation is to design an AK protocol secure against active attacks as well as leakage of stored secrets. So we proposed a new concept of AK protocols. We call it the leakage resistant AK LLAK protocols, you know, to provide maximum level of security against the active attacks and against the leakage of stored secrets. And the concept of the LLAK protocol is kind of a two-factor authentication, because the client uses the the one password and also address the store secrets. These two, the information are using in the LRK protocols. At the end of this protocol, if authentication is successful, they can these store secrets on the client side and sub side are updated. The compared with the previous AK protocols, the LRK protocol provides several interesting security features. It's secure against eavesdropping and also provides protection against parallel online attacks. The most what I want to stress here is that the LRK protocol provides the leakage of stored secrets from client side and server side. Sometimes at the leakage of stored secrets from both sides. You can see that previous the AK protocol does not provide any the security against the leakage of stored secrets from both the client and server side. Actually, there are several interesting advantages of LRK protocols. As I said, the LRK provides the higher level of security against the active attacks as well as the stored secrets, the leakage of stored secrets. Also, these protocols are designed to provide the efficiency in terms of the computation and communication cost. And also, in the LRK protocol, user just remember the only one short password. In the previous LRK protocol, you have to remember the many different passwords. And also, we consider the extension of the LRK protocols for data security. Actually, if stored secrets data are leaked, and then data encryption is not the fundamental solution to data leakage, because the fundamental problem is how to protect the data keys securely. So we provide a solution, you know, to realize the online data key recovery by using the LRK protocols. And we also propose it to merge single modes and cluster modes. The cluster mode is established designed to provide the availability of the data key. Anyway, our LRK project, the goal is to build a secure user authentication and data storage system based on the LRK protocols. And I just show some demonstrations. This is the core part of the LRK protocols. That actually, you can see the account file that is used. They included some stored secrets needed for authentication. So user just remember the input his personal password, and another secret is used in order to authenticate with the server. So actually, showing the debugging mode, so all of the messages changed between the client and server side. And actually, the time is running out. I just skip. And the second demonstration is to realize the OpenSSH by using the LRK protocol as the AK part. And sorry, time is running out. And the third one is some kind of the credential retriever for applications. So if you're interested, I can show you later. Okay, that's all. Thank you.
Right, 1024 with 768. No. Go down to basic. There you go. Try now.
You want 1024 by 768. Oh, that's good.
Sorry. It's my pleasure to be here and have some talk about the work that we are doing on, at Carlton on exploitation-resistant RAS model for open distributed systems. So to be briefly, trust is a subjective expectation an agent has about another one's future behavior based on the history of encounter. And reputation is the opinion or view of someone about something or someone else. So you guys, most of you guys have seen a lot of practical example of the trust models. For example, you have bought something from eBay. After that, you buy that product, you are asked to provide a feedback for the seller. And all of these feedbacks will be accumulated and form a reputation for that seller. So trust and reputation models have usually assist entities in deciding how, when, and who to interact with, and model trustworthiness of potential interaction partners. And the two main utility of the trust models are minimizing the risk of interacting with others by avoiding interacting with malicious entities and identifying community of trustworthy societies. So if you see this picture, so we are here, we want to go there. We want to trustworthy agents work together, interact with each other, and malicious agents work together. So we want to separate these two communities from each other. So there are different characteristics are proposed for trust models to, for example, be multidimensional, converge quickly, precise in modeling, adaptive, efficient sets of computation. But we are introducing new characteristics, which is exploitation resistance. By exploitation resistance, we mean that we imply that exploitation resistance imply that adversary cannot take the advantage of the system by knowing the parameters or how the system works. So this knowledge should not give the advantage to the adversaries. So we have modeled a game theoretic decentralized reputation model, and which is compatible completely with the features of open distributed systems and use the different source of information. And each agent can have two type of direct interaction and witness interaction. That direct interaction can be mapped to any type of the direction based on the context. For example, if you are in the e-commerce, direct interaction is buying or selling a product. If you are, for example, using this model for peer-to-peer system file sharing, direct interaction is uploading or downloading a file. And for witness interaction is when one agent asks about trustworthiness of another agent from some of its friends. So this reputation will be accumulated, and this asking and answering, we call it witness interaction. So we introduce two type of the attacks for trust and reputation model. Individual attacks that which mostly concerned with attacks that are mounted by only one agent. And we introduced Kahneman attack that I will briefly explain about that. And we introduced the collusion attacks that usually mounted by a group of agents. And we introduced witness-based collusion attack. So a Kahneman is someone who takes advantage of someone else by usually by playing a confidence trick. A confidence trick is a game that usually the Kahneman tries to increase his trust. And then when his trust is high, do defection, do fraud. So, simple question. If you have 100 microphones and 10 of them are faulty and 90 of them are good, so how you can sell these 10 faulty microphones that you still have a good reputation in system? So easily, you can sell 9 good microphone, 1 bad microphone, 9 good microphone, 1 bad microphone. So you usually do this. You can have this pattern of interaction. Build up trust by cooperating, selling 9 microphones, and then defection for a higher risk interaction, selling bad microphone. And you can repeat this cycle. So we don't want to understand who is the con man, but we don't want to let the con man to regain the trust easily. So this is the research objective of R, to not let the con man regain a high trust value easily. So we propose two heuristics for the con man that cautiously increment trust after defection and larger punishment after each defection. So based on these two heuristics, we change the existing trust models, and we see that, okay, the conman can be recognized in these trust models that they don't used to be recognized by the trust model. So in another attack that we include, we use witness collusion attacks, and we conclude independent modernization is useful. Work that we have in progress is development of richer attacks and proposing solution for them, analyzing real interaction by using some data from eBay or Amazon and understand what is the existing exploitation in them and find some solution for them and the extension of our model.
Hi, my name is Tom Moyer. I'm going to be talking today about some work I've been doing recently on scalable web content attestation. So when a user browses to a website, say a banking website, as you can see here, and they connect over SSL, they have some sort of clue as to the identity of the system or the server, but they don't really have any idea of what the state of the system is, or what the state of the web page itself, the content they're viewing is. And as a user, I would like to know that the content I'm viewing, in this case, say, a login page, I want to know that this page is actually the page that company, that in this case, say, Bank of America, that it is actually their login page that I'm seeing and not something that somebody has spoofed. And so SSL doesn't provide this, and so what we're looking at is leveraging technologies such as the TPM and integrity measurement to actually be able to provide this information to the end user so they can make a more informed judgment of whether or not they should trust the content they're viewing. So we have two goals in mind for this work. We want to be able to bind the integrity of the content to the system state such that the user can make informed decisions, and we want to be able to do this binding very efficiently. And so we built a prototype system that involves essentially a web server with some additional code on the back end that processes or performs this binding and provides the information to the end user. And so we've done extensive tests over to understand the performance of this system. And one of the things we learned very, very early on was that the TPM performs very slowly for the operations that we're interested in. And so we needed to explore a wide variety of different optimizations in order to get this system to perform well in high load circumstances, such as a web server serving many thousands of pages a second. And we were able to, with our prototype implementation for static and dynamic content, get the overhead down to about 13% to 15%. And so In doing this, we were able to actually provide a very clear binding between the state of a server when they host some content and the content actually being served. And we've been able to do so in a very efficient manner to provide such services under high load environments such as web servers that are hosting, say, your login page and all of your bank information. So with that, I will take any questions that anybody may have.
Hi, I'm Damien Octo from Penn State University, and I'm going to talk to you about the decompilation of Android applications. So you've all seen the keynote address. So now you know that Android applications run in a virtual machine, which is different from the traditional Java virtual machine, which is called the Dalvik VM. It uses a bytecode which is completely different from traditional Java bytecode. So the thing is that we have tools to do some bytecode analysis on Java bytecode, but we don't have anything for the Dalvik bytecode. So we can't really analyze Android applications the same way we analyze traditional Java applications. So this is something that we would like to do, and it's useful for several reasons. One of them is something that we've been working on actually at Penn State, which is to get the security refinements which are buried in the source code of certain applications. So our solution is to actually leverage the tools that we already have for Java. So you have to know how an Android application is compiled. So Android applications are programmed in Java. So you have the source code, which is compiled to traditional Java bytecode. And then this is translated by a tool called DX to the actual Android application, the DEX bytecode. So what we want to be able to do is to get the class files back from the DEX file. And the problem is that we don't know how to do that yet. And this is actually not easy for several reasons. The first reason is that the Dalvik virtual machine is actually register-based, whereas the JVM is stack-based. So it's the opcodes are completely different, and there are also some other issues so related to type recovery and also to the control flow. So if we get those class files back, we can use our existing tools that we have for Java bytecode. But you can also do some stuff such as decompiling the class files with existing tools. So we could get the source code back from an Android application. Our solution for that is a program that we made, which is called DET for DEX Decompiler. And I'm going to present the first results that we got from this program. So this is an example of a very simple method with just nested for loops. So this, as I was saying, when it's compiled to an Android application, it's first compiled to traditional class files. Then it's converted to a DEX file, which is the Dalvik bytecode. And this Dalvik bytecode is actually something pretty nasty. It looks a lot like assembly code. And it's basically writing to registers and invoking methods on the registers. And what we do with DED is that we actually generate some new class files, and we can decompile those class files by using, I used Fernflower for this one, which is a very good tool. And this is the code that we got. So it might not be obvious at first sight, but this is actually functionally the same code as the original code. So we can actually retrieve pretty much the same source code. But it's already something, but it's not perfect. So what we want is actually to get something more readable. So in order to do that, before doing our decompilation, what we do is that we optimize the class files by using the suit framework. And then when we decompile the class file, this is what we get, which is the exact same code as the source code. And with that.
I'm Haiwan from Penn State University, and I'm working on this project exploring the TCP of user applications with my advisor, Trent Shaker. So we all know what the TCP of an operating system is. So it has become a big and bloated one in most common operating systems like Windows and Linux nowadays. So you have a user application which has to depend on various user space applications, trusted applications, like for example the init daemon and various other things. And we also have the operating system kernel. So the user application has to depend on both the trusted applications and the operating system kernel, which is a huge piece of code. So what can we do about this? But from the point of a user application, we have not yet analyzed how much of the TCP it actually uses. So a user application, when taken in isolation, may actually cover much less of the TCP than all this. So why do I say that the TCP could be smaller? We have that not all parts of the kernel are security sensitive. So a process depends only on the security sensitive parts in the TCP. So you have, for example, a process that does its own encryption does not have to depend on the file system or networking code. And similarly, not all applications depend on all the trusted applications for their jobs. So our hypothesis is that typical user space applications, when taken in isolation, would use only a small fraction of the TCP that runs on a typical OS. And we aim to find out what this fraction is. So how could we use this? So there are various things we could do once we know the TCP of a program. So we could, the minimized code that we get might help us to prove the correctness of the code of the trusted computing base, or we could automatically deploy an application in a separate VM with only the dependencies it needs automatically once we know what it needs. For example, you have the Apache web servers being deployed in their own VM. So you have a stripped down VM image, which gets rid of all the unnecessary drivers. So why not do this automatically and provide some systematic method to do this? So this is also possible once we find the dependencies of an application. And our initial results actually make a point that not all parts of the kernel are used by an application. So we instrumented the kernel code using the gcurve tool. We instrumented the kernel using the gcurve tool, and we found that a typical application like the DHCP client uses 4.9% of the kernel when run on a Linux kernel for 2 days. So this was sort of stable. So this is something we call finding the slice of the kernel with respect to an application. And once we do this, we would, of course, have to identify the security sensitive parts and what programs it depends on. And there are several other interesting things to do, like you could get rid of the complexity of the resulting kernel by function pointers. So by getting rid of the function pointers. So function pointers are problematic for static analysis. So if we know that only a particular path in the kernel is followed, we could get rid of them altogether. And we could also look at automating the partition of an application into a separate VM. So in conclusion, I repeat that we believe that typical user space applications use only a fraction of the TCP that runs in a typical OS, and we aim to find out what fraction is really used. So that's my email, and if we have some time for questions, I'd be happy to take them. Thanks.
Okay, that worked. Okay, my name is Chris Alexander. I'm with the CRISP group out of the University of Waterloo. That's Cryptography, Security, and Privacy. And this is some work relating to my master's under Ian Goldberg, who you might know already. So it's based on some work that Joel Reardon did. His presentation was just a couple days ago. Hopefully you guys remember it. It has to do with Tor and TCP multiplexing in it. So remember, in Tor, you send your traffic through a bunch of different routers in the internet to get some anonymity. But if any two routers have multiple connections going through them, instead of creating separate TCP connections for each different circuit, they'll just use one TCP connection between each pair of routers and multiplex data between them. The problem with this is we hit two things. The first is head-of-line blocking. You're probably familiar with it. The sender has some information to send on, say, three different circuits, and a packet on one circuit is dropped, but the way that the receiver is going to see it is as one continuous stream, and as soon as it finds that there's missing data of any sort, it'll just stop processing data and not send an ACK and wait for, or not ACK that one particular missing part, wait for it to be retransmitted, and then process a whole lot of information all at once. Whereas in this situation, I mean, there's no reason we couldn't process blue cells and yellow cells instead of waiting for orange. They're on separate circuits. They should be independent. Another problem we run into is congestion control. Currently, if everything is one TCP stream and we have different circuits, one of which is transmitting much more than another, when congestion control is applied, we'll cut down everybody's send rate, whereas something more fair might be cutting down just the person who's sending the most. All right, so that's the problem he tried to fix. We would like things to look more like this, with a separate TCP connection for every circuit, but there are problems with that. Just making a lot of TCP connections is unreasonable because of all the sockets you'd need and the information you would leak. It's been proposed that you use a TCP connection between the endpoints of the communication and all the routers in the middle, just forward information via UDP. That was proposed last year, and you can read that paper if you would like. But there are some problems with it, and so the solution we're going with is the one Joel did, which is using a user-level TCP implementation so that in user space, everything's separated out into separate TCP streams, but what's actually sent outside of the encryption just looks like normal UDP. There are some problems with that, though. One problem is with a separate TCP stack implementation in user space for every circuit, that uses a lot of resources. It uses a lot of memory and other things. Also, there's a licensing problem with the particular version that was used, so we needed to change that. And there's a bundling problem. Remember in Tor, when you have to send data from a bunch of different circuits, you use a round-robin scheduling. So a packet from the first one, packet from the second one, packet from the third, and then loop back to the beginning. Now, sending this all in one multiplex TCP connection, you can combine data from different different circuits into one big packet to send over the wire. But with the implementation we had from Joel's work, it would require separate headers for every different circuit you want to send data on, because that would then later need to be transmitted to one of these user-level TCP stacks. So it's just less efficient. Not as badly efficient as this would suggest, but something on that scale. So a solution we have is to use SCTP, Stream Control Transmission Protocol. It's a newer protocol. It's designed to have multiple streams shared between the same two endpoints. It's better for sharing resources, and it lets it, because we're putting it in the user level the same way we did with the TCP stack, we can play with the congestion control mechanism again. So fixing the bundling problem from before, this is what we had with user level TCP. With SCTP, there's just a small amount of additional information, and it already has nice features for bundling that and unbundling it, meaning we don't have to waste so much header space. Also, the license is compatible, and it fixes the other problems there. Another thing we're fixing in Tor is something to do with fairness. So we talked about the round-robin scheduling, that if there are a lot of circuits all trying to send information, you just take information from the first, then the second, then the third, and so on. But what this does is if somebody is transmitting all the time, they'll always get their 1 over the number of connections bandwidth or better. But if somebody is doing something bursty, like HTTP, then they'll use nothing for a while, let everybody else have more bandwidth, and when they do actually need to send something, then they'll get a lot less. This is a problem because Tor is supposed to be used for things like evading censorship so people can access news sites and things which are mostly HTTP, and we don't want things like BitTorrent, which are always sending from using up all the bandwidth. Okay, I'm almost out of time, but you can imagine if one thing is sending a lot, a better way to do it than the naive send one from each is to send a whole bunch from one that hasn't transmitted for a while. So we did that. It's nice and being more fair. There's some stuff we still have to do, but I'm done. So thank you.
So that concludes our series of web talks. We have time maybe for some questions for those who want to call up a particular person from the web and maybe ask one or two questions. We can do that. Anybody have a question? If not, well then thank you. And let's thank the speakers again.
Yeah, I think this is the moment I've been waiting for a long time. I am officially ex-chair for the 18th USENIX Security Symposium. I want to thank you guys again for coming out. I hope you enjoyed the program. If you didn't, blame me. It's all my fault. I also take credit if you like it too. All right. So this year, what I planned on doing in closing was to make a... I told you at the beginning this was an extremely stressful process. And most of the chairs disappear afterwards. They take time off. And I really wanted to poke fun at my previous chair, the previous chair, Paul Van Oschot, but unfortunately he had to leave early today. The guy before him, Niels, has too much dirt on me, so I can't show those pictures. And Angelos Kiromidis, which was before him, is in the back here, and we all know he's traveling way too much to keep track of what he's doing. So typically the fun starts afterwards. After this is all done, then the chairs disappear and they're doing some things that are pretty exciting. It seems though that, we're on? Let's see. That the next chair, Ian, started a bit early. Let's see if we can get this working. Where is it there? On, are we still on? Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Have you synced?
I synced.
Yeah. Do again.
You should have come on.
What are you on?
I'm on. See. Chaz, what's up with your machine?
She must have broken it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Take this place.
Ian really doesn't want us to see to show these pictures. But whilst it comes up, I'm going to hand it over to... a member of the USENIX board to tell you about the next USENIX security. Thanks again for coming out.
Yeah, first and foremost...
Wait, there it is. Let's see. Can you see this? He started early, and he says that, you know, I didn't throw a good party. He's going to throw an awesome party next year. And you have an idea of what's going to happen, so.
So once again, thanks for you guys all coming here. Let's give Fabi another round of applause for the great job he did this year. As you said already, Ian Goldberg from the University of Waterloo is going to share next year's USENIX Security Symposium. It's going to be in Washington, D.C. from August 9th to August 13th, and I really hope to see you all again there. So with that, enjoy your remaining time in Montreal.